man.
Thank you for joining us for Live Paranormal Radio. From the paranormal to the unexplained, it all happens here.
It all happens here.
Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in our live video chat 24/7 with our live paranormal radio show host and other like-minded people. Live. Paranormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by Full Interaction Media. Stop by now and join the fun.
Stop by now and join the fun.
And hello, this is Chippicon, and you are listening to The New Normal on LiveParanormal.com. I have brought back this week Thor Halvorsen. Say hello, Thor.
Hello, welcome, good eve.
Yeah, Thor, we were having a conversation with Thor a few weeks ago, and it just, we didn't have enough time, so I brought him back again. We were talking about ethics and magic. I was talking specifically about I had mentioned a couple of books, specifically Robin Wood's When, Why, If, which is kind of a workbook that you can use to help yourself make decisions. One of the reasons for that was that when Robin was starting working, they didn't have a lot of books on Wicca. I mean, you could get the Golden Bough and the White Goddess and a bunch of other books on how witchcraft has been done historically, how it was done in Africa, things like that, anthropological stuff, but there wasn't any popular things until Weiser and Llewellyn started putting out popular books like Cunningham. And so when Robin was learning, she had her teacher did something that was actually fairly brilliant, but what it turned out later that he just didn't know anything about it. He was trying to impress the hell out of her. So he would tell her to experiment and say, well, what do you think, and what have you found? And she later acknowledged that was probably the best way of teaching somebody that you could get. And but it is still kind of funny that it should be done simply because there's a jackass who's trying to impress a young girl that he knows all the secrets of the universe and bullshitting and tries to and is trying to not let her know how little he really knows. That said, she took this good experience that she turned it into a good experience and created this workbook called When, Why, If, which is a way of looking at anything you might want to do and asking and figuring out whether if you ought to do it. And so that was a really good book. Another really good book that I recommend, and it's by Robin Wood, and I'm not sure if it's still in print, but you can still find it, used copies of it. Another really good book is the And It Harm None, which is by Shelley Rabinowitz, who it's also based on Wiccan precepts, which the basic one from Gardner is, and you harm none, do what you will. Now, of course, what you will is right up there with one of the most ambiguous statements in the world. And then, of course, you can really go a long way trying to figure out what harms no one. Frankly, if you look at I would like to see more corporations figure out where the harm they're doing is, because they don't pay much attention to beyond their immediate concerns. And I think that the world would be a lot better if people actually exerted themselves to figure out where the harm was going to be, because often we don't think about it. When somebody writes a law and doesn't realize what it's going to do, we'll stop everybody from coming into the country. What about the ones who are coming here for a life-saving operation? What if the ones, people don't think about where harm can come from.
World War II, the Ship of Fools comes to mind.
Oh, yeah.
That was where during the time, because we didn't want to piss off Germany and its ally. And at the time, Germany was an ally before we declared war on Germany. We blocked refugees from Europe then. And it was proven that Anne Frank's own family was turned away from the U.S. So that never bodes well when you're turning people back towards the fire, so to speak. We had the capacity, surely, to take in the refugees coming from Europe. Now, admittedly, the lid was so tight on Germany and the other countries that they didn't know for a while what was going on in terms of the atrocities. They knew the Jews were targeted, and they knew that people with disabilities were targeted. They knew that gays and lesbians were targeted. They knew that political enemies were targeted immediately, and so forth. It all comes down to, it's easier to point fingers in hindsight. It's easier to say when you've got the full picture and the weight of history on your desk that you could say, all right, I know this didn't work, this did work. But when you're talking about actions that are in front of you, it's not always that easy to tell what is the next thing that happens. And so it's really easy to judge looking back, but it's hard to judge looking forward. There is a lot of people who are hopeful that Trump is scaling back government and trying to give the country back to the people. But there's a lot of far-reaching ripples from that are going to be beyond his presidency, such as, for example, the legitimization of hate groups in our country now. We have a known white supremacist actually being an advisor to the President of the United States. That is a very scary thought. That's a very unconscionable thought. It's hard to wrap your brain around it. And yet at the same time, the only recourse we have is the safeguards and the checks and balances that our government has established from its onset. That is getting involved in the local elections. That is being attentive to who become delegates. And for sure, we have to undo Citizens United. That just opened the floodgate for what would, prior to that, be unwarranted influence, undue influence on the electoral process, where money can overpower the voice of the people. And this is what happened. So, it's difficult. Getting to your point about will, I was really thinking a lot about that from my previous show, and I thought about that. Will was the one thing that, if you look in the Christian sense, Adam and Eve, the attainment of free will was when they got pushed out of the Garden of Eden, because they made a choice. And then they had to accept the consequence of that choice. So it goes on from there. there's a lot of stuff that went on from there. And there is a lot of debate about where do you draw the line on free will. Well, usually one of the quotes is, your freedom extends as far as the nose of the next person when you're throwing the punch. But then there's also emotional, there's psychological, there's physical, there's magical abuse. You know, you hear the term psi vampires, you hear the term, oh, that person just pushing negative energy at me, I can't deal with that. There's stuff like that. So there's a lot of different things that way. You can affect the room by what energy you bring forth. So it's, if you can change the mood of a room, just how you enter the room and what energy and what mindset and what you project, then you're influencing through magic, you're influencing through will. So in the same notion, somebody who's firing off half-cocked mad and they have the knowledge of magic behind them, are they subconsciously invoking magic as well? Probably. So this is where you have to look on a deeper level of that too. The, one of the things I was told when I started this path was, once you start on this path, it's not something you can undo. Because once you gain knowledge of magic, it's a responsibility. Because you gain the ability to work with the elements. You gain the ability to be aware of the magic, the energy, the vibes, the nuances, etc., of the world around you. Even on a personal psychological level, but even on a what is the word I'm looking for? Physics. There's a movie that's a great example of this. It's called What the Bleep Do We Know?
Oh, it's a great movie.
Beautiful stuff. That movie was awesome. If you ever want to understand how energy works on a scientific level, that movie explains a lot of it. And it at least explains the mechanics of magic, because this is how things like how psychics work. It's how things like Reiki and stuff, how all that stuff works. It's because everything is moving atoms, and energy is the interaction between those atoms. Things are only solid because of the physical properties and the chemical properties between those atoms. So in a sense, yeah, you could look at the way that Neo looked at the world from the Matrix and say, yeah, everything is sort of interconnected like that. If we could see the world in a microscopic way, we would see all the microorganisms and stuff. We would see all the atoms and things. When we study biology and chemistry, we see how all that is interrelated. The chemical bonds between the elements make up the structure of the physical beings of the organs and the skin layers and the hairs and the interaction between the elements like the potassium and the Krebs cycle and the ATP cycle, how that all works. So, yeah, we are an embodiment of that. So, okay, going back to will, your will can influence a drop of water as it freezes. That was one of the examples at the beginning of that movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? Our emotions, our energy, can affect the shape of a crystalline particle of water.
Are we talking about work in freezing the with different energy, with that different emotional thing?
Yes. And it's been proven. There was a Japanese scientist who had a glass that they had somebody hold, manifesting different emotions and different thought patterns and energies and so forth, and immediately froze them. and you could see the difference that the emotions had on water particles. So if we are predominantly water, we're manifesting that same kind of energy throughout our body. So they say that what we put our mind to creates stronger synaptics in the brain. The more we make associations, like how we learn is through associations. You associate an experience with an object, with a smell, with a touch, with a sense, and then that is associated with the memory, which is associated with that object. The more you experience that same result, the stronger that synaptic connection becomes and the stronger that memory becomes. So same thing with our will. This is where that whole basis of consent comes from, because it's what you put your energy for. That was one of the things that they talked about in the book, where things have to be consent. And that's true, because consent means it's shared. If it's only going one way, then you're running into a wall, essentially. It's not going to have the same kind of energy interaction. You're not going to have invested emotions. You're not going to have thought process. You're not going to have memories built up. You're not going to have emotional responses, things like that. All those things that are part of a relationship. So that's part of it, too, is that we thrive as a society by relationships on many levels, from the personal to the societal. So when it comes to ethics, a lot of religions have that basis of how you treat others should be governed on how you want to be treated. You see that again and again and again through different religions. When it comes to paganism, yeah, it's there, but it's also how we also see and take care of ourselves. We can do, there's that quote that your worst enemy can be yourself. And that's true. So that also is harm. Now, granted, there are some people who have mental illnesses and stuff that go on that actually, it's not simply a changing of a perspective. It's not simply getting a change of scenery or something like that. You know, that takes, you know, an involved effort of counseling and, if necessary, medication and follow-up, things like that. So, yeah, that's still a part of self-care, is knowing when you need help and doing the necessary steps to bring yourself to a healthy state. And so, yeah, any effort that we do that invests in ourselves, as in our joys, our happiness, these are things that you don't find out there. You find it within. So we get pushed for certain things. If you ask people in a line, what do you get motivated for in life? If you ask that same question to five people, you're going to get five different answers.
If not seven.
Then you ask them, huh?
If not seven, if not more than five answers.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But my point is, you ask those same people, what has not changed in 5 years? What have you always gone back to? What has been the most consistent part that you've been motivated for, be it music, be it art, be it research, be it some crafts that you do, or things that you're passionate for, like, for some people, it's politics. For other people, it's philanthropy. For some people, it's
interconnecting with the community. For some people, it's gaming. But there's that common thing that reverbs throughout your life, and those things make you unique from other people. Those are the things that are given to you by the gods. They are what make you you. A lot of people misconstrue that deny thyself thing. It's actually the basis of lying to yourself. It's denying the things that make you you. That doesn't mean going around unrestrained and just saying, I won't say no to anything. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there are gifts that we're given that make us unique from the next person, things that motivate us, things that are deeply rooted in us, that define who we are. Those pursuits, that's what you feed. That's what makes you you. That's what gives you the inner joy. And you have to feed it, just like you do a plant. And so that's where the being honest with yourself comes in. That's where having that balance between the mango and anti-mango that they were talking about in her book. And you are as important as any one of the other people, but not as all the other people. Not always equal, but equally important. So what that means is you are just as important as anybody else. Other people are important to you because of their influence on your life and their contributions and their investments in your life. Same thing with ancestors. But you are important. This is where a lot of people, when they have to figure out who they are, you first look at what you enjoy. And that begins to tell you about yourself. See, when you start in a small nuclei family, your experiences are limited to what's in that family. Then you go out into the community. Our first level of interaction is our skin, touch. Babies constantly touch things. They want to put things in their mouth. They want to get a taste for it. They want to see it. They want to put their hands on it. They get a sense of distance, size, weight, smoothness, rough. Oh, this hurts. This is hot. This is cold. That's why when you're building up language, one of the first descriptors they use is it bigger than you? Is it smaller than you? Is it rough? Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it, you know, those basic descriptors, those are our first levels of interaction. And that's also where we begin to understand magic, because when we start working with magic, one of the first things that somebody did to show me that magic was real was to put their hands palm up in front of me. And they put their hand over mine and they said, feel for the change, the pressure, the temperature, the wave, the pulse, without even touching them. To sense their being without touch. Very basic.
But the beginning of energy.
That was the beginning. So that's where, when we look at ethics, how we approach somebody, we have to recognize our energy is part of that. Our actions are part of that. One of the first rules that they tell people generally is love spells are taboo. You don't put a love spell on somebody. Now, there's a difference, and the book went into this too. You can do a spell where you make yourself ready for love to build up the trait that you want in love that best matches you. But what you can't do is take away somebody's right to choose. You wouldn't want somebody to be with you who's not really invested against their will. So that's not love. That's That's control. So at that point, they're not there because they want to be. They're not a part of the relationship because they want to be. They're there because you forced them through magic. You forced them through coercion. You forced them through intimidation, psychological manipulation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are not acts of love. They're acts of control and influence. So this is where you have to look at the basis. What's love? What's joy? You know, love are things that build up. Love is things that want accountability. Love is things that want communication. Love is things that want interaction, time, effort. Same way that we interact with the gods. This is a common thread. How we relate to everything is that balance. We want that time, energy, investment in ourselves, in other people, and in the gods and in our ancestors. It's a common structure, a common desire. Is that pretty
much? Yeah. I like to interact, but you're covering these things in such a good way. You're doing a good job. I'd hesitate to interrupt.
Now, I studied transpersonal psychology. I've also studied a little bit the dabbling in a field called psychoimmunophysiology. Big word. But what it basically means is the study of the self, the psychological self, to the physical self, to the outside world. So I see it as going from how the mind relates to the body, how the body relates to the mind, and then comes the external experiences that go on from there, how we interact with others, how society influences us, and how we can actually an effect upon society. If you look at people like Martin Luther King, Gandhi, John Lennon, many, many others, they are people who understood the world and the universe so much that they were able to affect from an individual level to a societal and cultural level. That's a lot. That's a lot of influence. That's a lot of energy, dynamics, charisma, leadership. This is somebody who is not willing to sacrifice their ethics, their ideals, their values. But if you look at people like Martin Luther King, it really wasn't about self-worship, unlike the person who's inhabiting the White House right now. It was more the service. It was more of, how do I leave this place better than I found it? How do I do my job to try to elevate this society to a better place? And it was somebody who believed enough in themselves to know, I can make that change. That's profound. That's recognizing the way how magic works on a grand level. And it all starts with intent. They say the first step towards solving a problem is to recognize the problem exists. Check. And then recognize that changes need to be made. And then you have to identify what are those changes that have to be made. Check. And then what actions can you take to bring about those changes? He recognized that looking at the past, I'm talking about Martin Luther King here, looking at the past, he knew what worked and what didn't. And the best way to disarm those who would stand against you is through an act of nonviolence. Now, that's powerful in the sense that it's the same as somebody who expects reciprocated anger and hate and malice instead to be greeted with a hug that says, I understand how you feel, but can we talk about this? Instantly disarms them. Because
sometimes
they don't have an outlet now. They've built up a wall. And suddenly they realize all that energy was wasted. Hate, anger, we laugh about this in the sense of Star Wars where they say, you know, hate fuels anger, anger fuels hate, and that's way to the dark side. Well, there is some truth in this.
Yes.
In that biologically, it actually takes more muscles to frown than it does to smile. That means we are biologically predisposed to want to be happy. It takes more energy to be negative, to be angry and stuff. It takes a physical toll on our bodies. It can make you sick. Extreme hate and anger can make you physically ill. Anger. It can rattle your nerves. It can give you high blood pressure, which is dangerous to your health anyway. So,
which is what the show was last week. Kathy Kane was on, and people can find that in the archives. But there is so much stress now that I had Kathy on with techniques for protecting yourself from stressful illness. In situations like now.
Right. And the idea is affect change at the level that you can. In other words, make yourself the best person that you can for yourself and then start from there. You can't affect change with an empty cup. You can't be a teacher unless you have something to teach. And that takes experience, that takes wisdom, that takes love. So this is where, okay, we look at our society right now. There's a lot to worry about. There's a lot to be afraid about. I mean, just today, Trump unrolled the actions that former President Obama did in allowing students in school who are transgender to be able to go to the restroom in accordance to their sexual identity. That can be different from biological identity. Transgender is a transition. So if it's male to female, they are female. Even if they haven't gone through all the processes, they identify as female. So that's what they are.
And I've got to jump in here. And say,
huh?
And if they I've got to come in and say, and if they are even most of the way through the process, and you say they have to use their birth gender bathroom, you're going to have a whole lot more people uncomfortable because you have forced this guy to go use the ladies' room when he's clearly a guy. And
and that inflicts harm.
Not only is that bad for him, but it's also
not dangerous.
The other women in the bathroom better. It's like, geez, they're just not thinking. But anyway.
It's not about thinking. This is not about what's right or wrong. It's about what they perceive. It's power. It's power.
Yes,
divide and conquer.
It's the
class.
Theory that if we make abortion illegal, now I can respect that there are people out there who really see abortion as infanticide, and with that perception, of course, they're going to do everything in their power to stop it. But because they of the way they see it, they see that as infanticide. And I'm very sorry for them because I personally, with my various studies and things, see that some people may enter the body when the mother has just gotten pregnant. And a lot of them will just slide in there while the body's going through the birth canal. There is no one time when the spirit enters the body. So to define a potential human being is based on their perception of a spiritual activity. And is, and since we're all supposed to have the right to make those calls for ourselves, it seems rather.
Well, at that point, where do you draw the line? I mean, look at people who are in coma on life support. You know, this is where you have to look at the basis of quality versus quantity issue. And we already have a plethora of people who have the ability to be parents, but they don't have the capacity to be a parent. And so this is where, are we doing more harm than good if we have an overpopulation and then you have a huge chunk of society that's basically in stagnant gears, can't get out of poverty because they can't control their family size, so that further impoverishes them, and they can't get out of poverty because, you know, every time they, you know, I mean, I don't know that somebody should have to, quote unquote, abstain from having relations with their partner just because, well, they don't want to have a baby because there's no birth control available. You know, that's one of the reasons the things exist in the first place, was to allow a family to still be close without necessarily having to have a kid every time they have sex. You know, we don't live in aggregarian society anymore with the high infant mortality, to where we have to have large families because we don't know how many of them are going to reach adulthood. Infant mortality is actually down. So therefore, and we have a lot of diseases and stuff that have been countered. Now, of course, then we get into the whole argument of immunization. That's a whole nother subject there.
Yeah, but we're getting in, let's, sticking back to where we are looking at ethics and magical things, we are looking at a situation of how do you make the decision? How do you decide what it is? There are people out there who truly don't think that anyone who hasn't got a religion, and I hate to say it, many of them will say if you aren't Christian or at least a faith of the book, either Jewish, Christian, or Muslim, that's not religion. And
well, see, what do you think that they've done with mythology? Unquote.
But they have
mythology.
I'm just saying that they don't. They say that you cannot have ethics if it isn't based on religion. And I think that there certainly are ethics which are based on.
There's rules.
Good.
There's rules. They're called laws. Laws are not based in religion. Societal norms are not based in religion. So yes, you can have rules and you can have ethics that aren't based in religion. A whole country was founded on the basis of rules without religion. That's why our Constitution is not a religious document. Our Constitution is a social document. It's a legal social document.
Marriage, which many would like to define as being between a man and a woman, or in other words, being the way their religion defines it, has traditionally throughout history, over most of the history of the human race, been a socioeconomic agreement, a contract between families on what obligations are necessary to support offspring.
It's also a right of inheritance
of the families. And so that is what is essentially a social contract went from being, okay, we've got a social contract, which is being blessed by a priest, to oh, it's only the ones that are being blessed by priests are real marriages, and they have to follow the rules of the priests that are in charge. It's gotten
very... That's two different things.
Yeah.
It's gotten very confused. You have the ceremony that is religious, but the certificate that you sign for marriage is just like our license to become clergy. It is merely the certificate that becomes the legal document. The legal document is not religious. It's legal. The ceremony is religious. This is why we can have people married.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I like the idea that if before you got married, you had to go to a lawyer and have him go through the basic laws that are on a... That pertain to marriage in your jurisdiction and explain them to you. And I bet you a whole bunch of 16-year-olds who had stars in their eyes would turn around and say, excuse me? No, I don't think so. And maybe put off getting married for a little while if they realize.
This is where people go through marriage counseling.
They should do it before.
Not always. There are people who go through marriage counseling before they get married.
Well, that would be good.
They get counseled on what it means to get married, what are the expectations of a marriage, what does it really mean. And so, yeah, I actually like that idea because people need to understand
what you're getting into.
Understand when it comes to a marriage, it's more than just a simple, there's a lot of things that go into that. Is there expectations? Are they expecting their partner to change who they are once they get married? There's the expectation, do I now own you? Do you have to listen to me and follow everything I do because I'm the man of the house? You know, so there's role expectations, there's societal expectation, there's financial expectation, there's also status expectations that go into all of this. You know,
I think that,
and then you have the daily things of balancing the chores or balancing the many different facets of time, and you know, this is where there was one person they had on Oprah that was talking about spiritual partnership, and I really liked that idea, and that was where a partner is somebody who has accountability, and they expect to want the best of that person. So, for example, my personal philosophy when it comes to a relationship is you have to respect the individual. Even if two people get married, they're still individuals. So they will still have their own dreams, their own experiences, their own ambitions, their own feelings and thoughts and desires. You still have to honor those even if you're married. They don't disappear and you just become an extension of the other person. No, that's an imbalanced relationship. You have to honor all those facets of that person still. So I see it like the rune R. So, Rad, I see it like that. Two individuals, they come together, they share their experiences, they share their memories, they share their time, their effort, their energy, et cetera. They make an agreement to share all that. Then they go out, they do their job, they have their own time with friends, et cetera. They come back together again. And it becomes interweaved so much that then it becomes to look more like, hey, an eight, and then it twists, and they got experiences, good, bad, whatever, they work it out. They get more of this overlap. They have more memories involved, more feelings involved, et cetera. And eventually the relationship will kind of look like something we see in biology, which is the double helix or DNA. Our energy works the same way. What do you think about that notion? Lucia? No, I'm still there. So,
that's my own personal stuff. When it comes to ethics, you have to think of the other person as a complete entity and go from there. So the same respects that you would want for yourself, you have to offer first. Same thing with energy. You don't do something without somebody's permission. You can ask, is it okay if I extend energy for you for good, for your benefit? But they have to say yes. And there's ways that you can do that. But you always have to be mindful of respecting the person. And that's one way that you could know, you know, do I know that they would be okay with this if I do it? That's the first thing you ask. If you don't know them well enough, ask. So, but I do recommend the When, Why, and If. I do recommend that book, In Harm, And Ye Harm None. There's other things, like if you follow the heathen path, there's the Havamal. The Havamal is a collection of Norse sayings, and they also have to deal with the gods. It also deals with interactions with people. They have a set of norms. And a lot of ethics is built in society, and we often have to revisit that. Right now, our country is in the process of revisiting the definitions of our values and discussing. We are discussing all of that as a society. So it's going to take a while to work it out. Okay. Tipakana, are you still there? Hello? Tipakana, are you still there? Okay, she's having a little bit of technical difficulties, I think, on her end. Oh, you can't hear me? I can hear. Can you hear me? Uh-oh, technical difficulty. Oh, scheisse. What about now? Can you hear me now? Hello? You there now? I seem to have lost the call. Oops. I can hear me, but can you hear me? Can you hear me? I'm not hearing anything on your end.
I can't hear you either.
I've got my phone on speakerphone and I'm still not hearing anything. Lewis said they can't hear me either. Okay, they said I'm still. Okay. Okay, so you can still hear me. All right. Tipakon is having issues, I guess. I thought I was off. Okay, fine. The Havamal is a good book if you're trying to understand the Norse perspective of ethics. They deal with how to interact with other people. For example, you don't leave somebody on your doorstep and, you know, you bring them in out of the cold. You give them dry clothes. You give them warm food to eat because they've traveled. It's an expectation of hospitality. So there is a show on Netflix right now that I really recommend. It's called The Journey of Kindness or something of kindness. And it talks about a guy who basically went around the world just on the basis of compassion and kindness. He had no money,
He asked people for gas and for lodging and for food, and he managed to make it around the world just based on compassion. It's really a good thing, and it makes you feel good about humanity kind of deal. But he went into countries that there was not a discussion about beliefs. It was all about the person, that basic interaction between people. Hey, I need some food. Will you be willing to help me out? And there's a lot of erasure in our society when it comes to homeless people, when it comes to the poor. And when you look at that, you know, it's real easy to pass them by, but it's a battle because our society tends to ignore that homeless people exist. And their idea of dealing with homelessness is just have a few shelters that you bypass between churches for a bed, and they give you some food once or twice a day. But they're not really addressing the problems, which is they need lower-income housing, they need support networks, they need lower-based jobs where they can get into and get retrained for the job force. So there's things like that. So we can look at things on the society level, too. We can look at the hate that's infesting our society right now and decide, I'm not going to have a part in this. So what do? You live the best life you can live. You do the best thing that you can do that follows your ethics. You do what's right that you know is right. The best of your ability. If you see somebody doing harm to somebody else, do something about it. Don't be a bystander. If somebody's being bullied, don't be a bystander. If you see somebody throwing a brick through somebody's shop because of who they are, don't just stand by. Stop them. Hate is only alive because it has an audience. 10 years ago, the whole idea of somebody who embodies hate sitting in our White House seems like something that was unimaginable. I can guarantee you the people of Germany in 1925 had no idea that the next person that was going to control their country would be Hitler. You know, they had a normal election. Well, unfortunately, it was all false pretenses. Holy shit, this sounds familiar. So you have to look at this. As a society, how do we heal? How do we go forward? We have to counter the hate with love. And we have to stand up for what is not right and act accordingly. Raise our energy. Push forth positive healing energy and just do it nonstop. We have to combat this. We have to make